KZFR 90.1 FM is pleased to announce the upcoming concert with Todd Snyder. October 22nd at the Paradise Performing Arts Center.
I'm stepping down.
Return of the storyteller, Todd Snyder, will be bringing you a one-of-a-kind concert. With special guest, Lily Winwood, daughter of classic rock legend Steve Winwood. There will be all your favorites, like Beer Run,
B-double-E-double-R-U-N, Beer Run.
Plus songs from Todd Snyder's brand new album, First Agnostic Church of Hope and Wonder. All proceeds benefit KZFR 90.1 FM. Tickets can be purchased at kzfr.org/Todd Snyder. October 22nd, doors open at 6:30 p.m. Todd Snyder at the Paradise Performing Arts Center. Purchase your tickets today.
This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Up next, Ecotopia. Tonight, we'll be reviewing some recent and some actually pretty good news on the environmental front. This is Ecotopia on KZFR, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, technological. From time to time in this program, we like to read from recent news that fits with our show theme. Today, we'll look at some technological approaches, some of them involving old technology, to global warming, and we'll catch you up on recent news from Earth Justice.
Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Chico Certified Farmers Markets, featuring three markets in Butte County, year-round markets in and Chico at the North Valley Plaza on Wednesday morning, and at 3rd and Wall in downtown Chico on Saturday morning. There's also a seasonal market in Paradise on Tuesday morning. The Chico Certified Farmers Market, connecting farmers and food lovers since 1980. Ecotopia is also made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Alternative Energy Systems, providing sustainable energy for life. Alternative Energy Systems offers solar, battery storage, and whole home Generator Solutions. More information at 345-6980 or visit savingenergyforlife.com. The opinions voiced on Ecotopia
Do not necessarily
reflect the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, or underwriters.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR. I'm Stephen Trudy. A couple of months ago, we did a book review of Elizabeth Kolbert's book, Under White Skies, The Nature of the Future. In it, she offered the thesis that since humankind has engineered itself into a threatened collapse, it might be able to engineer its way out. Examples she presented were new levees and dikes in the Mississippi Delta, which did, in fact, work better for Hurricane Ida than they did for Katrina. Another of her positive engineering solutions to an engineered problem was electronetting in the Chicago River to discourage carp from invading Lake Michigan. But we have to remember that the Chicago River itself has been engineered for a century. It's got a dam that blocks the flow into Lake Michigan and sends that water down to the Mississippi River, from whence cometh the carp in the first place.
I'm Susan Trudy. We did an interview with Michael Hausman, author of Technofix, who argues that there are no magical technofixes in our future. We can't keep abusing our planet and expect technology will somehow reduce or reverse the damage, whether it be plastic in the sea, carbon dioxide, methane emissions, or misuse of agricultural chemicals. We'll read now from an article in the New York Times that seems to blend both positions, using existing technology to solve ongoing problems.
Somini Sengupta writes, trams, cable cars, electric ferries, how cities are rethinking transit. The roar of engines has long been a part of the soundscape of a city. For a century, for billions of urban people worldwide, getting around has meant boarding a bus powered by a diesel or an auto rickshaw that runs on gasoline, or, among the affluent, a car. Today, a quiet transformation is underway. Berlin, Bogota, and several other cities are taking creative steps to cut gas and diesel from their public transit systems. They're doing so despite striking differences in geography, politics, and economics that complicate the transformation. Berlin is reviving electric tram lines that were ripped out when the Berlin Wall went up. Bogota is building cable cars that cut through the clouds to connect the working-class communities perched on faraway hills. Bergen, a city by the fjords in western Norway, is moving its public ferries away from diesel and onto batteries, a remarkable shift in a petrostate that has for decades enriched itself from the sale of oil and gas, and that now wants to be a leader in marine vessels and the electronic age. Bergen's buses, too, are now electric, supplied by Chinese bus makers that have seized on the market in cities as far afield as Los Angeles and Santiago, Chile. The change is audible. Quote, you can hear voices again in the streets, said John Askeland, the mayor of the county that includes Bergen. Urban transportation is central to the effort to slow climate change. Home to more than half the world's population, cities account for more than two-thirds of global carbon dioxide emissions. And transportation is often the largest and fastest-growing source, making it imperative to not only encourage more people to get out of their cars and into mass transit, but also to make transit itself less polluting and more efficient. According to C40, a coalition of around 100 urban governments trying to address climate change, transportation accounts for a third of a city's carbon dioxide emissions, outstripping other sources like heating, industry, and waste.
Continuing with the Times article about transportation, it hasn't been all smooth sailing. In Costa Rica, for instance, private bus operators are divided on the national effort to electrify mass transit. In Chinese cities like Shenzhen, which has a fully electric bus fleet, the electricity itself still comes mostly from coal, the dirtiest fossil fuel. And everywhere, it's expensive to make the shift. At the moment, only 16% of city buses worldwide are electric. The electric switch will need to accelerate, and cities will have to make mass transit more attractive so fewer people rely on automobiles. Felix Krutzig, a transportation specialist at the Mercati Research Center in Berlin, said it has become a reasonable position to advocate for less space for cars. 10 years ago, it was not even allowed to be said, but now you can say it. The biggest challenge has been faced by cities that most need to make the shift, the most crowded and polluted metropolises of Asia and Africa, where people rely on informal mass transit, such as diesel minivans or motorcycle taxis. But where cities are succeeding, they're finding that electrifying public transit can solve more than just climate problems. It can clean the air, reduce traffic jams, and ideally make getting around town easier for ordinary people, which is why some politicians have staked their reputations on revamping transit. In many cases, city governments have been able to take climate action faster than their national governments. It requires political clout, Claudia Lopez, mayor of Bogota, has said in an interview. For the past 25 years, Bogota has been condemned to depend on diesel buses. That's irrational in the 21st century.
Switching gears a little bit in this article. During the Berlin Wall era, many of the city's trams were ripped out. Ingmar Stries called it a historic mistake. By 1967, when Mr. Stries was only 3 years old, West Berlin had taken out nearly all the tracks of Die Elektrische, the electric. Cars took over the roads. Now, 30 years after the fall of the wall, as Germans confront the perils of climate change, there are growing demands to reclaim the roads from cars for walkers, bicyclists, and users of public transit. Enter Die Elektrische again. The mistake of the 1960s is now being corrected, said Mr. Stees. He's a Green Party politician and Berlin's permanent secretary for the environment and transport. Berlin, along with several European cities, including Lisbon and Dublin, are reviving trams not only to clean the air, but to curb emissions to meet the European Union's legally binding climate standards. These goals are requiring a 55% reduction in greenhouse gas by 2030 compared to emission levels in 1990. Felix Kreutzig, the transportation specialist for the Mercator Research Center, says it has become a reasonable position to advocate for less space for cars. Still, the politics of taking space away from cars is tricky. Berlin, with 1.2 million cars, has enacted a congestion tax, but it applies only to a tiny slice of the city. It's all part of a broader effort to improve public transit, including by electrifying all buses by 2030, expanding metro and suburban trains, adding bike lanes, and building almost 50 miles of tram lines by 2035. But the trams are not universally liked. Critics point that they are noisy, rattling along crowded streets day and night. They're slower than subways, and in the era of car shares and electric scooters, they seem old-fashioned. Tram fans point out that they are cheaper and faster to build than subways. Like so much else in Berlin, the story of Berlin's trams is a story of a partitioned city. As Die Elektrische dwindled in the West, they kept running in the poorer, communist-run East. Today, one of the trickiest tram projects involves extending a line called the M10 across the historic Oberbaum Bridge that linked the former East and West Berlin. Inga Kademeyer, 41, riding a packed M10 late one Wednesday, welcomed an extension to the West. Quote, "Everything that reduces cars in the city is useful. If it connects to the West, that's a nice idea. It would add a second meaning to it." But building a new tram line on the bridge would mean taking lanes away from cars or bikes, or the city would have to build another bridge altogether. Mr. Stries was not ready to say how the tram might be accommodated, but one way or another, he said, a tram would cross the Otterbaum no more than 2027. It's not going to happen very soon, he said, but it's going to happen.
In her Times article, Somini Sengupta turns next to Norway, where we have some personal experience taking an electric ferry. Yes, all electric. Heidi Wolden spent 30 years working for Norway's oil and gas industry. Today, she is working to put oil and gas out of business in her country's waterways. Ms. Wolden is the chief executive of Norled, a company that operates public ferries increasingly on batteries instead of diesel. Ultimately, Ms. Wolden hopes to take her ferries well beyond the fjords. She wants to make Norled a leader in electrifying marine transport. It is part of Norway's ambitious effort to electrify all kinds of public transit, a plan all the more remarkable because Norway is a very small, very rich petrostate. Personally, she said, I am extremely happy that we are moving in the right direction. As Helstad, a car ferry that Norled operates, set off from a quay near Bergen. Norway has set ambitious targets to cut greenhouse gas emissions by half by 2030 compared to 1990 levels. Almost all of Norway's own electricity comes from hydropower. But what to do about its own oil and gas industry is at the center of a robust national political debate. Elections in September brought a center-left coalition to power, including small parties pushing for an end to all oil and gas exploration in the North Sea. Bergen is keen to fast-track its transition away from fossil fuels. Its city buses and trams run on electricity. Taxi operators have been told they must switch to all electric vehicles by 2024, with subsidies for drivers to install chargers at home. Ferry operators have been offering longer, more profitable, have been offered longer, more profitable contracts to offset the cost of conversion. Unlike some other countries, including the United States, where climate policies are deeply polarizing, in Bergen there isn't much pushback. Mr. Askeland said politicians on the left and right agree to trim the budget for other expenses to pay for the costly electric ferry contracts. After all, the mayor said, voters in the area are conscious about directing climate change. That influences us politicians, of course, he said.
I have to say, too, that when we saw the electric ferry on which we rode close to Bergen, Norway, I was just blown away with it. This was a full-size ferry full of cars. How did they get that much electricity? We couldn't get down below decks to see the battery pack. But that is explained partly in the next section of this article. Because ferry operators aren't the only private companies cashing in on the electric transformation. Corvus Energy, which makes batteries for all sorts of marine vehicles, including mind-bendingly for oil tankers in Norway, is busy producing batteries for electric ferries. Quote, the government using purchasing power to change the world is also very important for us, said Geir Borkelli, the chief executive of Corvus. The company now has its eye on electrifying ferries in the United States. Corvus batteries sat snugly under the deck of the Hellestad. On shore, cables dangled from two tall poles that a passerby might have mistaken for lampposts. The ship's chief engineer, Arvid Alvesser, grabbed the cables with both hands and plugged them into the ship's battery pack. Watch out, Arvid. Don't grab those things by the electrodes, eh? The 10 minutes it took for cars to pull into the ferry was enough to load up with enough power for its roughly 45-minute voyage up the fjord and back. And again, that just blows me away that they can do that. That's kind of old battery technology. Reinvented new style batteries, but still pretty astonishing, and a suggestion of what we can do with electricity in the future. Mr. Alvesaker was at first dubious about running a battery-powered ship. It took less than a week for him to change his mind. I was dirty up to here before breakfast, he said, pointing to his upper arm. I don't want to go back to diesel. He has since bought an electric car. The water was calm that morning as the ship left the quay almost soundlessly. On an electric ferry, there are no roaring engines.
Bogota, Colombia, has overhead gondolas with Wi-Fi for commuters. The Transmi cable is a loop of firehouse red gondolas that glide up from the valley to the neighborhoods stacked around the hills that surround Bogota. There are plans to build 7 lines as part of the city's effort to clean up its public transport. Nearly 500 Chinese-made electric buses are on the roads, and contracts are out to buy another 1,000 by 2022, making Bogota's electric bus fleet one of the largest of any city outside China. The mayor, Ms. Lopez, a cyclist, wants to add roughly 175 miles of bike lanes. But for Freddy Cuesta Valencia, a Bogota school teacher, what really matters is that the Transmi cable has given him back his time. He used to spend 2 hours on 2 slow buses crawling through the hills to reach the school where he teaches. Once, he said, traffic was so backed up that none of the teachers could arrive on time. Students waited outside for hours. Now it takes him 40 minutes to get to work, an hour at worst. There's Wi-Fi, clouds, rooftops below. It's a lot less stress, said Mr. Cuesta, 60, a folk dance teacher. I check my phone, I look at the city, I relax. For politicians like Ms. Lopez, electrifying public transit helps her make the case that the city is aggressively cutting its emissions. But if she can also make transit better, not just make it electric, it can attract voters, particularly working people who make up most of the electorate. But overhauling transportation is expensive. For Ms. Lopez, who belongs to a center-left political party, it requires negotiating for money from the national president, Ivan Duque, who belongs to a rival conservative party. Yet their parties have managed to find some common ground. Mr. Duque is helping Ms. Lopez build Bogota's first metro, something mayors have been trying for decades. The case she made to him? What's good for the city is good for the country. If Bogota can't change its transportation system, she said, Colombia can't achieve its climate goals. You're interested in having a more competitive city? It's our common interest to achieve Colombia's climate change goals, she said. And again, that comes from an article by Somini Sengupta, an international climate correspondent.
When we lived in Nevada a dozen years ago, we came to think of the Southern Nevada Water Authority as a totally evil entity. This based on its proposal to ship water from eastern Nevada to Las Vegas via an 84-inch pipeline. That's about the same size as the proposed Delta Tunnel. Bad ideas in both cases. As John Wesley Powell once suggested, leave water in its natural basins. That also applies to Northern California water as well. But here's a Times article that puts Vegas in a somewhat better light. Victor Jakes of the Las Vegas Review-Journal brags about some of the steps Sin City has taken to cut down on water use. 2 decades of drought, he writes, have significantly reduced the water level at Lake Mead. The world's biggest bathtub ring is there for all to see. Things aren't any better up the Colorado River. In August, federal officials issued Lake Mead's first ever water shortage declaration. That meant cuts in water allocation, and more cuts are likely in coming years. Many people, including Southern Nevada Water Authority General Manager John Ensminger, blame global warming for contributing to the falling water levels. For the sake of argument, and I have to say here we disagree with the author, Mr. Jakes, for the sake of argument, he says, leave aside any doubts you may have about the connection between human activity and global warming. Decades of failed predictions and the demonization of those who dare to disagree tends to leave one skeptical. We are also very skeptical of people who write things like that. But, he says, assume the most recent Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report accurately foretells the future. Many people do, and some of them are panicking. At the Youth for Climate Summit, activist Greta Thunberg said, our leaders' intentional lack of action is a betrayal toward all present and future generations. A quarter of childless adults said climate change factored into why they didn't currently have any children. This, according to a 2020 Morning Consult poll.
Victor Jakes continues. Now, if anyone has reason to worry about global warming, it's Las Vegas residents. This is a desert. We are enduring a seemingly never-ending drought. The river that supplies 90% of our water is wasting away. So why are people moving here? If global warming were the only consideration, residents would be fleeing. But weather conditions aren't the only variable in human outcomes. Adaptation can mitigate many of the harms caused by adverse climate events, even drought. For 2 decades, the Southern Nevada Water Authority has done just that. It paid homeowners to get rid of their grass. A ban prohibited lawns in the fronts of new homes. And it worked. The authority says there's been a 47% 5% reduction in per capita water usage since 2002, despite having around 800,000 more residents than in 2002, the Las Vegas area uses less water today than it did then. The Water Authority has also built infrastructure to stretch Las Vegas's water. It built a new intake tunnel under Lake Mead. It oversees a system where 99% of indoor water is treated and returned to Lake Mead. That earns credits, allowing us to make more water in the future. This is why new housing doesn't strain the region's limited water supply. Thanks to wise planning and mitigation for most Las Vegas residents, the most tangible impact of a two-decade-long drought is less grass. That's a real downside, but it's a far cry from a world-ending crisis. Adaptation such as this has happened all over the world, and climate-related deaths have plummeted accordingly. Hoover Institution visiting Bjorn Lomborg found climate-related deaths dropped by 96% over the past 100 years. The next time you feel panic over global warming, look at Lake Mead. It's an object lesson in how humans can adapt and thrive despite changes in climate change. Steve and I respectfully disagree with that notion. However, the notion of being able to save water, to have very aggressive water conservation, is the sensible part of this article. Mm-hmm. And it's something that Chico really needs. People can grow food in their yards instead of having lawns. People can use drought-tolerant plants. People can get the green cover that they need without having extremely thirsty grass growing in their yards. And I think that's a direction that everyone in drought-challenged places needs to go. And we will be having more droughts because of climate change, more dry weather here in the West.
Yeah, we don't disagree. I think we applaud what Las Vegas has done, but he's got a really cavalier attitude about what's to happen next. He's saying, in essence, since we've saved water, we continue to grow, no problem, we'll solve it. It ignores really important questions like, why build a city in the desert in the first place? Why place money and expansion of Las Vegas and other cities above creating a livable environment for people and living within one's environmental means? So by no means are we consonant with his view that everything is swell if you apply even new or old technology. He also has unwarranted faith. He's kind of a climate denier. He says, stop worrying about it if we can believe other people. The future is very grim. Well, yes, we can believe them. There's no doubt about that.
We'll take a short break and be back with encouraging news from one of our favorite NGOs, Earth Justice.
Save the planet for another day.
You are listening to Ecotopia on FM 90.1 KZFR, Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Stay tuned to KZFR this evening at 6 p.m. It's Bobby Tryon with North State Give and Take. She interviews movers and shakers in our part of the world. Tonight she'll be talking with Katrina Woodcox of the Butte Humane Society. Then at 6:30 is Ginger Nichols with Radioactive. It's a great mix of her choice of music with eclectic commentary. We also want to alert you a week from Thursday, October 10th, be sure to catch Gail Kimball at 6 p.m. Dr. Gail will interview people from family-owned businesses with a history in Chico, Northern Star Mills, Collier's Hardware, and the Brucey Funeral Home. We also want you to be aware, if you're not already, that in just a few minutes, 6 o'clock, the Chico City Council will convene. They have two crucial issues on the docket tonight. First, they are going to review their plan to abolish the Chico Climate Change Commission, a commission that was established about a year and a half ago with staff support to help Chico meet its goals. The City Council a couple of weeks ago decided it would abolish it as a commission and turn it into a committee with no staff support.
And they have actually created an ordinance to do that. That's the only way that they can do it legally, is through an ordinance. So they've drafted an ordinance, and this is a time for people to make public comments. We need the Climate Commission. The Climate Commission has come up with many ways of activities for thinking about, for enacting how we can reduce CO2 emissions. We need that kind of aggressive action in our community, and even making it an ad hoc committee, as it once was, eliminates the kind of staff support that it currently has as a commission, and we need it to be a very active group. And so please go to City Council and oppose having the commission disbanded.
And a week from tonight on Ecotopia, we will be talking with Cherie Chastain.
She's the chair of the commission.
And so she will have lots to say based on what happens in tonight's City Council meeting.
And then what other thing is happening tonight?
The other item that you need to be concerned about is they are decision to apply for an emergency shelter declaration status, which could bring about $1 million to the city and possibly help to solve some homeless issues. The City Council, as you know, very conservative, let the previous shelter declaration expire. I opine it was mostly because they didn't want to. They were offering the argument that housing in the parks was not needed because there was plenty of shelter space in Chico land, which is not true. Now they're seeing a little bit better, and apparently the city attorney has drafted something. It's important to let particularly the conservative council members know that we need the shelter crisis declaration. It costs nothing, and it's a good thing for Chico land.
And it brings us a lot to solve the problem. So, City Council, we forgive you for jumping in your car or on your bicycle right now and heading to City Hall where you can respond to these issues. This is Ecotopia on KZFR, and we're reading some stories that offer at least somewhat optimistic takes on the world climate issue. Earth Justice is one of our favorite nonprofits. It's a national organization, and it litigates climate. It litigates environmental issues, not just climate issues, but endangered species issues, air and water pollution, and so forth. And they've got a pretty good track record. And so we'd like to tell you about some of the things that we've learned about what they're doing. Its aims are, quote, to wield the power of law and the strength of partnership to protect people's health, to preserve magnificent places and wildlife, to advance clean energy and to combat climate change. Its mantra is, we are here because the Earth needs a good lawyer.
So Earth Justice has been involved in a number of lawsuits. One in Madison, Wisconsin, six tribes filed a lawsuit in the Western District of Wisconsin against the state for its planned November wolf hunt, claiming the proposed hunt violates the tribe's treaty rights. Wisconsin's Natural Resource Board approved a quota of 300 wolves for the upcoming November hunt, more than double the quota of 130 proposed by the Department of Natural Resources. That's a recommendation that is also considered by experts to be too high, not supported by scientific data and analysis. Do we need to hunt the wolves at all would be the question. This November proposal follows a disastrous February hunt. The Ojibwe tribes asserted a treaty-protected right to half of the wolves in ceded territory in Wisconsin in order to protect those wolves from Wisconsin's rushed and ill-advised hunt. Nevertheless, in just 3 days, hunters using packs of dogs, snares, and leg-hold traps killed 218 wolves, exceeding both the state and tribal quotas, and killing up to a third of the state's population. So Earth Justice has joined in this. It represents the tribal nations Bad River Band of the Lake Superior Chippewa, Lac Courte-Oreille Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians, Lac de Flambeau Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians, the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, and the Sacogan Chippewa community, as well as the St. Croix Chippewa Indians of Wisconsin.
Another lawsuit that the Earth Justice is involved in is in San Francisco, or filed in San Francisco. Farm worker groups, environmentalists, and health organizations represented by Earth Justice sued the Environmental Protection Agency for approving continued use of deadly pesticide paraquat, which has been linked to Parkinson's disease. Paraquat is currently banned in 32 countries, including member states of the European Union, where the chemical is manufactured and exported, and China. In July, EPA reapproved the pesticide's registration for another 15 years. Paraquat is one of the most widely used herbicides in the United States, used on grapes, almonds, soybeans, cotton, and more. Its use has grown dramatically in recent years, doubling between 2012 and 2017, despite the serious health risks. Paraquat is acutely toxic when ingested, and even one small dose can be fatal. The EPA determined that exposure to paraquat can damage the respiratory system, kidneys, and eyes, but their final approval abandoned a proposed ban on most aerial applications of paraquat, leaving farmers who work in the fields exposed to unreasonable risks. EPA also dismissed the connection between paraquat exposure and Parkinson's disease, despite scientific studies finding that paraquat can increase the risk of Parkinson's by 150%. This paraquat registration puts EPA on the wrong side of science, history, and the law, with dozens of countries banning paraquat because of its severe health effects. There is no excuse for leaving farm workers and agricultural communities exposed to extreme risk, said Jonathan Kalmus-Katz, a senior attorney for Earth Justice. All major agricultural states are hotspots for paraquat use, according to the latest government data. But communities in Kansas, Texas, and southern states like Carolinas and Florida face extreme exposure, while nearby communities can be impacted by runoff and downstream effects. Paraquat is manufactured by several companies, including Chevron, Adama Group, and Syngenta, who are facing a growing number of personal injury lawsuits related to the use of paraquat and its long-term impacts on human health.
Earth Justice is also part of a coalition demanding change on airplane pollution standards. The headline of their article is, Coalition Blasts EPA Delays on Replacing Do-Nothing Trump Rule. Earth Justice is one of 100 environmental, community, and public health groups calling on the Biden administration to set strong standards to cut airplane pollution and avoid industry-promoted biofuel greenwashing. As the letter notes, the Biden administration has yet to announce any efforts to replace useless Trump-era standards, despite saying they need review. Instead, earlier this month, Biden officials announced tax breaks and voluntary programs to boost airlines' reliance on biofuel, also known as sustainable aviation fuel. George Orwell, turn in your grave on that one. Sustainable aviation fuel. Biofuels are not proven to be carbon neutral or sustainable. Some jet biofuels caused increased emissions of nitrogen oxide, an air pollutant associated with respiratory illnesses, including asthma. Quote, call it greenwashing or green wishing, but voluntary biofuel pledges won't save us from climate catastrophe, said Liz Jones, attorney at the Center for Biological Diversity's Climate Law Institute. Despite being by far the largest airplane polluter in the world, the U.S. has stalled any meaningful aircraft emissions rules for more than a decade. Enforceable carbon pollution cuts are better than all the aspirational ambitions in the world. They need to start now.
The Earth Justice Report continues that rather than overturn Trump's hollow corporate-friendly regulations for aircraft emissions, Biden is exacerbating the problem by propping up dirty, false solutions like biofuels, said Hallie Templeton, legal director of Friends of the Earth. This administration must swiftly and meaningfully regulate harmful aircraft emissions, finally doing the right thing for the climate and communities. Aircraft are a large and growing source of harmful emissions and yet remain largely unregulated, said Sarah Burt, deputy managing attorney at Earth Justice. If we're to prevent devastating warming of our planet and protect the public from harmful air pollution, we have to move towards zero emissions aviation. The Environmental Protection Agency must set us on that path with a strong rule that significantly and immediately reduces carbon emissions from this sector. In January, the Trump administration finalized airplane greenhouse gas emission standards that the Environmental Protection Agency admits don't actually reduce greenhouse gas pollution. The rules, which mirror those adopted by the International Civil Aviation Organization, or ICAO, are too weak to address the severity of the climate crisis. A previous analysis of those international standards found that most airlines in the U.S. covering three-quarters of aviation demand already meet the standards. By the time the rule goes into effect in 2028, the EPA expects all airplanes already comply with the standards or be phased out. As a result, the agency doesn't protect any emissions reductions from the rule. The center, along with Friends of the Earth and Sierra Club, both of which are represented by Earth Justice, filed suit in the U.S. Court of Appeals, D.C. Circuit, challenging the rule. Last year, the center released a report that explained how climate pollution from U.S. aviation could be cut by three-quarters or more in the next 20 years. The center, Friends of the Earth, and other organizations represented by Earth Justice sued the EPA to force the agency to set greenhouse pollution standards for airplanes. A judge ruled that the EPA is required to address aviation emissions under the Clean Air Act. Commercial aviation currently accounts for 11% of all U.S. transportation carbon dioxide emissions and 2.4% of carbon emissions around the globe. Despite a short-term downturn during the pandemic, this number is expected to grow in the coming decade. Flights departing from airports in the U.S. and its territories are responsible for almost one quarter of global passenger transport-related carbon pollution.
Following a lawsuit, Earth Justice was able to claim a victory in getting the EPA to update water pollution. Earth Justice notes that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency announced recently that it will update water pollution control standards for the slaughterhouse industry. This following a December 2019 lawsuit from community and conservation organizations. Quote, it's a great first step that EPA has finally decided to modernize the standards for meat and poultry plants across the country, which had not been updated since at least 2004. Said Sylvia Lamb, attorney for the Environmental Integrity Project. We now expect EPA to let us know when they plan to propose updated standards to protect our waterways and communities, since the current limits are allowing an excessive amount of pollution. Earth Justice attorney Alexis Andaman said, slaughterhouses are leading sources of nitrogen and phosphorus pollution, and their pollution disproportionately harms under-resourced communities, low-income communities, communities of color. We applaud the EPA for recognizing that it's time to update the outdated standards for governing pollution from slaughterhouses. Together with our partners, we look forward to working with EPA to ensure that new standards adequately protect people and the environment.
In a press release, EPA announced that it will initiate a rulemaking process to reduce pollution from three industries: meat and poultry processing plants, which include slaughterhouses, metal finishing businesses, and manufacturers of organic chemicals that discharge
polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFASs.
I thought I just said that. Along with its announcement, EPA noted that 74% of the slaughterhouses that discharge pollution directly into rivers and streams are within 1 mile of under-resourced communities, low-income communities, or communities of color.
More than 8 billion chickens, 100 million pigs, 30 million cattle are processed each year in more than 7,000 slaughterhouses across the country. An estimated 4,700 of these slaughterhouses discharge polluted water to waterways, including the iconic Chesapeake Bay, either directly or indirectly through municipal sewage treatment plants. The Federal Clean Water Act requires EPA to set industry-wide pollution standards for slaughterhouses and other industries, and to review those standards each year to decide whether updates are appropriate. This to keep pace with advances in pollution control technology. Thank you. So, these are good news articles from Earth Justice. If you're listening to Ecotopia on KZFR, in this program we've been highlighting some generally good news about environmental issues and projects. We don't intend to be Pollyanna-ish, and in these grim times, a little good news can help to restore optimism. So we hope these were helpful to you, even as we pointed out several flaws in otherwise positive reports. All of these issues are so complex that a little bit of good news does not necessarily exacerbate what human beings have done and continued to do to the earth.
I think it's really important to note that there are small efforts being made in many, many places. I feel that Chico is not in good faith in facing climate change. It's not the city of Chico, the city government of Chico is not acting in good faith to look at the needs that we have for climate change and for protection of our water and our resources. So attend city council and...
I was going to disagree slightly. The Chico, city of Chico has some pretty good green standards, proposing to put solar on buildings, requiring solar and all electric in homes and so forth. However, as Susan was saying, the Conservative City Council is in the process of trying to reverse a great deal of that through the abolition of the Climate Change Commission. And in general, the current City Council is not pro-environment. They're taking no significant action to strengthen what are also some reasonable maybe drop in the bucket, but reasonable changes to how the city is run. Susan, do you want to say anything about urban sprawl, which relates to all this?
Urban sprawl is a big problem. We don't need big houses out on the edges of town. We don't need Valley's Edge. We don't need Stonegate. We need to build in, not up. We need density. We need integrated communities where there people can easily move within their communities, not having to drive and create more emissions.
You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. We are always eager to hear from you. Send us an email at ecotopiakzfr@google.com. Check out our website where we post replays of our current shows, as well as alert you to resources that are significant in working toward a sustainable Earth. Thank you for listening.
You are the new day. If you can but prove to me you are the new day, send us on in time for dawn. Let the birds all hail the morning. Love of life will urge me, say, you are. Knowing we must bear thoughts occur that this night might stay yesterday. Thoughts that we as humans mourn could slow words and end it all. Lie
Up next is North State Give and Take, and it's made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Cotton Party, offering contemporary women's clothes and accessories with an emphasis on natural fibers in the heart of downtown Chico. Cotton Party has been providing friendly service for over 30 years and is located at 337 Broadway Street. Cotton Party is grateful for your business and offers complimentary gift wrapping with each purchase. More information by calling the Cotton Party at 893-4923 and by The Printed Image, providing screen printing and embroidery in Chico since 1980. The Printed Image is open Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. and by appointment. More information by calling them at 898-9525.